You said that you were expanding the business of the firm, and you started to run a book in UK equities. Was this a particularly difficult thing for you? Was it a completely different market, and you had to learn different ways?
Yep, totally different. It was the big changeover from being dependent on somebody. You always had your boss there, to going to starting on your own, where you were the boss man and you had a junior under you. Secondly, you could get a feel to stocks, and I, by this time, had got a range of the mining shares, and you knew if something would overreact, that you could take action. If it moved up too fast or too quickly or too far, you'd think, hello, that's gone too fast. Here you had to find a, well, learn again. And also the people were totally different, because brokers by then had their expert dealer in a mining share, their expert dealer in the equity market. So I was gaining to find a completely new crowd of people and having to find the feel of the shares and learn a little bit about the shares. Not that we as a company worked on the basis of knowing too much about the company. We were interested in what we thought the right price was, and whether we could buy them at a price and sell them at a price. So we didn't pay a lot of attention to it, but had to know broad terms. And it was frightening, it was worrying, and it was good, but it was pressure. It was pressure, and like a lot of things in life, you could have your good spells when it was marvellous, of course, and you could have spells where everything just went wrong for a while, and your timing might have been just wrong, and you were making a loss each day, so you were embarrassed, you know. And when the profits came in, and the senior partner said, "Well, how did you go today?" And some chap said, "Profit of so and so, profit," and you'd say, "Loss of so and so," and you felt you were letting the side down. But everyone, I think, had that type of spell. And you did feel bloody awful.
But did the other partners basically support you through this period, and they understood it was
very much
something
so,
new?
very much so. You know, one would say, "Come and have a drink or something now, any way we can help." And as I think it was patches one went through, and you got very down. I certainly got very down at times. And no, I think if the partner thought you'd gone off the rails and went out all night and drinking all night or womanizing all night, then some action would be taken. If the chap knew you were trying your best, and it was one of those spells, that then they would be supportive. In fact, at times they said, "Go on, clear off and have a holiday," because you mentally you were getting yourself into a state. So, you know, "Go on, go off and have a break for a week or 10 days," sort of thing. Come back with a clearer mind. And I don't know, these things changed. Suddenly you would just get an order and make a little bit of money again, and then the ball started rolling. I don't think you can go through a job like that in the stock exchange and expect to make money every day. Life's not like that, quite rightly so, really.
How did the other jobbing firms dealing in industrial equities react to Smith's starting to run a book?
I don't think there was a lot of enthusiasm. We were known as I think a first-rate house, very commercial house, and another competitor coming in then was take X amount of business away from them and probably trim the margins. And I think that did happen, in actual fact. And then you got down, ultimately, to two very big firms, with Durlacher and Ackroyd and Smithers, and then three others, Pinchin, Bisgood and ourselves. And I would think, going up to Big Bang, I think Smith had become the biggest jobbers in the equity market at the time of Big Bang. But there was a long haul in between times, and we were stretched for capital at times, I think, perhaps almost overexpanding, because we moved into quite a number of markets, and certainly moving to markets. And then, of course, you had a boom, and of course, the price of shares got heavier. So when you once started in Marks and Spencers were £1, by the time you finished, Marks and Spencers were £2.50 or £3. So you were financing more shares at heavier prices.
Was there at some point where you all took a decision to expand the firm's business?
Well, I think it was, as I say, I think it was always in the back of the partners' minds, to we had to get away from the reliance on South African mining shares because the political thing started at some stage, and the equity market was starting to move, and we were producing people inside the firm who were going to be quite capable of running their own books, and you had to give and let them take over. And yes, the firm wanted to cover virtually all markets, all the equity market, then perhaps apart from fixed interest or things like that. Yes, there was certainly conscious decisions. It was reviewed annually or biannually or what have you, and then situations would crop up. We took over one or two firms, smaller firms.
Yes. Can you name them?
Certainly Sanborn was one we took over, who were smaller than us, but good equity jobbers. We took over, I can't remember the name of the firm, Moy, I think Robert Moy, a rubber firm. Mm. And so we dealt in plantation shares. And then had a move into the gilt market, where we took over a tiny firm, R.H. Prance. Not with terribly good results. Probably were one or two others, which I can't think of at the moment.
But were you again, pursuing a merger policy similar to what Wed-Durlacher were doing?
No, not directly, I don't think. I think if situations cropped up, then we would look at them. No, basically we'd grown from in-house. We like to produce our own people, and we had our own style of jobbing. Yeah. We found when outside people came in that the styles conflicted somehow or other. It's not to say the chap wasn't a good jobber or what have you. Mm. There was just wasn't our style. So if we could produce people from in-house, we did. And it seemed to be quite a lot of people around at that time coming up through the ranks.
How did you manage these actual takeovers? Did you simply expand the number of partners, or did you mainly take on their staff, or did you take on their books?
Took on their books and possibly some of the partners, and let some go, depending on an age and perhaps an ability. I think with a lot of things, if we dealt at X markets and this house dealt in other markets, and again came about through a friendship or something like that, here was the chance to expand the firm.
What was happening to other jobbing firms at this time? Were many of them expanding, or were many of them simply disappearing?
Mixture. As you mentioned, I think Wed-Durlacher were expanding rapidly, and Ackroyd and Smithers, the two successes. Some, I think, were partnerships, and perhaps the capital was getting restricted, or the senior partner was thinking, I'm going to protect myself. Mm. And I say it was an unprofitable business at times, and if you were a small business, you could either merge or disappear. Mm. I don't know what the numbers were, but it came down dramatically during one of those slump periods, and certain firms were taken over or gave up.
Was the type of business changing, the size of bargains?
Yes.
Were institutional investors making a big difference?
Yes. I don't know what the stats are, but the private client's holding has gone down over the years, and the institutional side has gone up. And this certainly became a fact. And also, going towards the latter days, you were getting firms having discretionary accounts for private clients. In other words, if they had 5,000 private clients and they decided they were going to buy ICI, they had the discretion to buy those, and the order would come to the jobber as a block order. The jobber wouldn't know that broker was in 5,000 clients. All he knew was the broker wanted to buy 500,000 ICI or what have you, whereas a few years before then, it would have been a lot of brokers dealing 100 shares, 500 shares. Yes, it became a block trading system, very much so.
Did this create problems for the jobbers in terms of the kind of capital they needed?
Yes, I think so. Yes, capital and the risk of it. Take on an order in 500,000 XYZ, and if that stock was being recommended or something, within 10 minutes there could be another order in for $500,000, and you were looking at a fairly dramatic loss very quickly. Mm. It became more compartmentalised, if there is such a word. And again, I think you had your leading broking houses starting research and analysts, which was something that, if it did happen, it was minute in my early days, minute. And in actual fact, you also had one or two of the jobbing houses trying that. I think Wed Durlacher and Ackroyd and Smithers employed analysts themselves. We didn't. So our attitude was that was not our area at all. We were there to make the prices, and albeit if X is recommending a show, okay, let him put his money down, and we'll find the stock for him and try and get our turn out of it.
Well, were you at Smith's basically using your own capital, or were you relying on the banks?
Relying on the banks.
Yes.
Oh yes. Oh yes. Very much so. Mm. Yes, I don't think you could have survived without borrowings from the banks. Mm.
With a number of other jobbing firms competing directly with you, contracting with the general shrinkage.
Yes, it's been in my career. It became a shrinking thing. I don't know the numbers. I think when I started, there must have been 60, 70, 80 jobbers, and you were down in broad. I think at the end of Big Down, it was down to something like 17 in number, of which 50% of those were small houses, and it came back to we were back down to the big five in the end. Mm. I mean, we in actual fact nearly merged with one of the five, with Biscuit Bishop. In fact, terms were agreed, and then the monopoly stepped in and said they were going to review it, and by the time they'd agreed that it could go ahead, the world had changed and it didn't go ahead. Mm. But as against which, I'm absolutely convinced in my own mind that even you say the numbers were down to three, eliminate Biscuit if you want and one other, to my mind it was still highly competitive.
This is one thing I wanted to ask you about, because an outsider would say, well, it does look as if there's a potential monopoly situation. How does competition operate in this environment?
Well, I would put it down to it was two or three heavyweights slugging it out as against 10 or 15 lightweights or however you want it. All I know is that I finished virtually jobbing when Big Bang finished, and the competition was huge from the other jobbers. And if an Ackroyd and a Wed were making prices in Marks and Spencer's, and I don't know store shares, and I was, I knew I had to be on the ball because these were two big houses that would take my business away from me. Mm-hmm. It was highly competitive, highly competitive.
Did you feel with eventually only 17 firms that you each still had your distinctive character, that there was something distinctive about Smith's and the way Smith's did things? Or were you more or less all tending to become very similar?
No, I think there were different styles, different backgrounds to the individuals. I think, not so with the sour grapes, Wed and Ackroyd built up their business mainly through the Gilt Edge market. Mm. No, mainly, I say mainly, a large percentage of it came from the Gilt Edge market, and therefore they could pump money back into the equity market. We didn't make any money from the Gilt market. on the reverse, we lost money. And I think there were a different style. I think Wed were almost recognised as the establishment firm as such, with Ackroyd very close behind or even overtaking at one stage, and we were still pure market, pure jobbers, if you want, and that was our philosophy all the way through. We wanted the brokers to come to us to know that the deal was clean, that we didn't have any research or what have you. As I say, I think the others were building it to an extent. And Biscuit, I think, were less significant in a way. And Pynchon, I think, were a better firm, it's an individual view, on the bear tack. And of course, you had a bull market for a number of years, so they weren't quite so effective towards the latter part of the time.
And can you say anything about the much smaller firms?
Well, trying to think. Certainly, there's one of the equity firms, a firm by the name of Jenkins, who had their niche in some of the smaller companies, and they were very good, very good. And I think they had connections with some of the holiday camp people, etc., etc. The shares they dealt in, they were very good. Who else was about? Harold Rattle, who I didn't know very much about. And of course, some of them were in the gilt market, which wasn't my area at all, or fixed interest markets, which I didn't know a great deal about.
Now, you continued to run your equity book right through until Big Bang, and you were steadily moving up in terms of seniority in the partnership,
mm-hmm.
were you?
Yes.
How did that actually work? It was one person retiring, so you would all move up.
To an extent, yes. I say the four originals when I started had obviously gone by then. Then Tony Lewis took over as chairman, and it was Tony Lewis, brother and myself, and a chap by the name of David Heath, who were the next four in line, seniority or ability or what have you. Then from there it evolved again. And that was, I found, the most exciting time, because that's when, as far as the firm's concerned, it started to roll really forward. And mixture of ability and connection as well, and trust.
And how would you go about making policy? You would have regular partners' meetings? And
certainly not to start with. I would say it was all very informal. It was still very much a partnership, and we were friends, and I think policy came up if something cropped up, sort of thing. But we were so close socially as well that we knew everything that was going on at the time, and if something major had to happen, yes, then we'd sit in a room and discuss things. But now it's board meetings and sit round a table, and the meeting will start at 4:30 or what have you. This was much more informal. When you could keep your eye on 100 people, for example, and know everyone, and most of them were in the UK, whereas now splattered around the world, and talking about, I don't know, 1,000, 1,200 people, and obviously it's got to be different.
Did you ever have to think consciously about things like recruitment, or did that simply naturally take its course?
From what I can remember, it basically took its course. I can't recollect that we were ever that short of dealers, basically. The back office I knew nothing about, but the dealing side seemed to work itself through. As I say, and basically we were slightly unhappy at taking other jobs from other houses. Obviously, if there was a merger of some sort, you took them and people came through, but to take individuals seemed to us not quite to work. And I can't recognize, yes, there were times when you might have been short of two or three people, but you couldn't have it always, because if you've got it ideally, then you'd be overemployed at some stage. No, basically, I don't think there were problems like that.
And at some point, Smith decided to incorporate.
Yep.
Now, what were the reasons for that?
Well, this was, broadly speaking, if I remember right, quite truthfully, I think the elder partners wanted to get out and get a touch. I think there were a variety of reasons given at the time. Some might have been tongue-in-cheek things. I think, quite truthful, that was the main reason.
But did it actually make any difference to the firm itself, the way it was structured, or...?
I think it made a difference, which didn't become apparent at the time, in the attitude, because here was this friendly partnership, and I think, certainly I thought, well, it'll carry on, we won't be disturbed, and then... And quite rightly, it had to be disturbed. You were now accountable to shareholders and not to yourself and your mate who lived round the corner. And I think also it put bigger pressure on. You were in the limelight all the time. And you had to disclose your figures and you had to explain why they were good, why they were bad or whatever. Whereas, as I say, as a partnership, when you had a bad time, you could thump somebody on the nose and say, we better do something bloody well about this, but here you're... The chairman had to get up and explain to shareholders, and it was a business that had its ups and downs. However good you were, if there was no business, there was no profit.
But you were still all, as individuals, going down to the floor of the house each day?
Yes.
And trading as jobbers?
Yes.
Had the actual art of jobbing changed terribly much since you'd started as a dealer? The actual doing business face-to-face?
No. In broad terms, no. As we said before, the size of the business got bigger, which will happen. No. I think it's... You can't teach somebody jobbing. I think it is a flair business. You can be the greatest mathematician, but that doesn't necessarily help you. You can know everything you want to know about a company. Doesn't necessarily help you at all. No, I think it is an absolute flair business. I think, as I said before, I think it works on being commercial, being hopefully trusted, and having some sort of personality that you would attracting your customers to you first primarily so that you saw the business and also that if you saw it from customer A, who was one of the big fellows, customer B might be the one where you could unwind that business through. No, I don't think it did change up to Big Bang.
And what about the stock exchange itself, pre-Big Bang, say late 70s, early 80s? Had that changed as an institution since you had joined? A lot of the practices and the habits changed, and the customs of the way you...
It became more serious, without any doubt. The frivolity went out of the place, and it became a working place totally as such. It must have changed in other ways, and I can't really think of them because you were getting to the stage, I suppose, where quite clearly it was going to open up globally as such. But sounds blase. I think one was still involved in one's own firm, I was certainly in broad terms, and wanted to steer it to Big Bang to be a major power. Perhaps if Tony Lewis sees you, he'll be able to be more explicit than that.
Did you feel any pressure on you as jobbers for the system to change, for the abolition of single capacity?
Yes, there was. There was big pressure on. Well, I mean, there was a huge PR job done, I think, and most people would say it was necessary to change because of the internationalisation of the place. I think it's right, but I have certain doubts about it all, certain doubts, and I suspect a lot of the people working there now might have their doubts about it. I think the biggest mistake was the change came so dramatically. This was upturning an institution of 200 years and saying, within 2 minutes, totally changed. And I think had it been a more gradual approach, then less damage would have been done in the last 3 years than has been done. I'm absolutely convinced of that. I don't even do that with anything in life, something that's worked for 200 years, and then to turn around and say, day one, we've turned that upside down, now you start again, there must be damage. Has to be.
What would you say had been the main strengths of the jobbing system?
The main strengths of the jobbing system.
In what sense do you feel the jobbing provided a particular service in the stock exchange that, and the way stocks and shares were traded that perhaps is no longer there?
I think what I would call a freedom of dealing, in that there was a flexibility which I don't think exists now, because you have a visual screen which says the price is such and such. And prior to Big Bang, you could make your price, and if a broker said no, you could make your price and say that they were 100 to 2, and if the broker said, I'm a seller at 104, you say, I'll buy those. And I don't think there's that flexibility around now. And I think that the visual screen destroys a lot. To watch in the morning 16, 17 houses, and you know that of the 16 or 17, 12 or 13 are waiting to see who's going to put the first price in, so they've got a guide, I think is wrong, because you went in there and you made your price, and your friendly bro said, Christ, your price is totally different to the one that Aykroyd's making. I'm making it. Or you'd adjust it. And now you've got this thing set up on the screen, and it's lost its flexibility.
Just concluding, are there any particular personalities that you do remember now from the 60s or 70s in jobbing or in the stock exchange? People who might have had an influence on you or seemed to have a big impact on their markets at the time?
Well, quite clearly, the two that had the biggest impact on me were the two I first worked with. I said Sidney Lowes and Henry Marks from rival firms. Yes, there's one who I competed against in our bank market who worked for Wed Durlach, a chap by the name of Michael Bennett, who I think was an extremely big thinker. I thought he was a pain in the neck at the time, but he was a lovely man and a big thinker. Again, it was this flexibility. There were some big men in there. I'm sure there'll be some big men now, but there were people that did dominate markets with their power of their personality or what have you. A man I didn't know terribly well, a man named David Blackwell, I think dominated the oil market for a while. Certainly in the mining market, this chap George Lazarus was a wonderful man. You never quite knew what money they'd made, because it was all very secret. I competed against a very nice chap when I was running our, what we call our leader book, the ICIs and the corridors, and this chap chap by the name of Colin Smith. He was not one of the establishment people, just a damn good jobber, and he made it impossible for me to make money, and he left several years ago, and I was talking to one of Wes, and he said, well, you never made a light for us. And I used to stand and think, how in God's name is he doing that business with so-and-so? You know, he must be making a fortune. He said, oh, he never made a light for us. But of course you didn't know at the time.
Were there any rogues on the stock exchange? I mean, were there people known to have been sailing fairly close to the wind? I mean, we don't necessarily have to talk about the last few years, but...
Yes, there must have been. Always were. I honestly can't think of them offhand. Of course, yes, I think there was sailing clubs, the good sporting type. There's the one that sailed close to the wind. There's the one that sailed over the wind. So yes, there must have been villains, chaps that quietly disappeared. But only, I think, for... Well, no. I think if you disappeared, then you'd done something dishonest. But the dealing thing, you weren't allowed to deal in theory on a backwardation. If a jobber's offered price was lower than the next jobber's bid price, in other words, there was an instant turn to be made. I'm sure people did that, but that was the stock exchange code, and if you found that chap out, then you put the bars up to him next time, and you made your own decisions. But that wasn't, that was in-house villainy, if you want to. Yes, there were rogues. But not all the rogues were in the stock exchange. The city gets tarnished, I think, at times by rogues who have dealt on the stock exchange, but there can be nothing to do with the stock exchange, but city gets the blame for it.
Well, finally, the last question, did you ever consider leaving jobbing, or were you quite satisfied with the career that had given you?
No, I don't think I ever seriously considered it, and never seriously considered leaving Smith. It was certainly from the 70s onwards, when one was beginning to get involved in the executive, if you want, of it. It was hard work but great fun, and I have to say, one's made a reasonable living out of it. I have to say, I think worked hard and played hard. No regrets about it at all. No regrets.
Good. I think we can stop there.